All right, well, good morning. It's the 3rd of December, and we're going to look at Matthew 1, the genealogy. I don't know why I got interested in this week, but probably because I usually don't get excited about genealogies. And since it's sort of the time of year to once again look at the texts from the birth stories and Jesus' infancy narratives, I thought this one would be interesting to do. And so I had a lot of fun doing it. I got a lot of, I looked heavily into Davies and Allison International Critical Commentary, which is just studly. It's awesome. Morning, just started. Morning. Just telling Danny and what's your name again?
Thomas.
That we're gonna look at the genealogy of Jesus and spend some time in a genealogy today and see what we can come up with and wrestle with. So we're gonna be looking at Matthew 1, his version of the infancy narrative genealogy leading up to Jesus, and we'll be flipping through some other texts as well. But I thought we would start by just reading it, just reading verses really 1 through 16, or 17, 1 through 17, and then we'll ask some questions and just kind of dialogue together. So maybe take a few verses and then just kind of go around the room, whoever follows you. I'll start, and then maybe Thomas, you could. You have some heavy reading.
Yeah.
You want me to pass my Bible when I finish? Okay, so Danny, you can read after me.
Okay.
A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Aminadav. Aminadav the father of Nachshon. Nachshon the father of Salmon. Go ahead, Danny.
Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. Boaz begot Obed by Ruth. Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king.
David was the father, English pronunciation. Solomon, his brother, had been Uriah's wife. Solomon was the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam was the father of Abijah. Abijah the father of Asa.
Asa the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat the father of Jehoram. Jehoram the father of Uzziah. Uzziah the father of Jotham. Jotham the father of Ahaz. Ahaz the father of Hezekiah.
Hezekiah the father of Manasseh. Manasseh the father of Amon. Amon the father of Josiah. And Josiah the father of Jeconiah. And his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon.
After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel the father of Abiud. Abiud the father of Eliakim. Eliakim the father of Azor.
Azor the father of Zadok. Zadok the father of Akim. Akim the father of Eliud. Eliud the father of Elazar. Elazar the father of Mathan. Mathan the father of Jacob.
Jacob the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ or Messiah. Thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Christ, or to the Messiah. Okay, so what is Matthew trying to do? Why does he throw a genealogy in front of his gospel? Where does he get the idea from? What is he trying to do? Do other gospels have a genealogy? What other gospels have a genealogy? Luke does. Does Mark or John?
Doesn't Mark?
No. Mark starts right with the baptism. So there's something that Matthew and Luke are interested in, that they include a genealogy. There are some obvious differences between Matthew and Luke. We're not going to spend too much time or much at all dialoguing about the differences. I just want to focus on Matthew this morning. But Maybe where is Matthew getting this idea from? Any guesses or ideas?
Legitimacy.
What's that?
Legitimacy.
Legitimacy. Yeah, that's a valid point. I mean, trying to establish legitimacy of who Jesus is. So who is he? What is Matthew trying to say? What is he trying to say?
Descendant of David.
Okay, so he's got a direct lineage to David, but he also includes, he doesn't just start with
Abraham.
David. He goes all the way to Abraham. Right, so there is a direct linkage to David. This whole beginning part from 2 to 6, from Abraham to David, this actually agrees with Luke's genealogy in chapter 3 of Luke. Except this, there's only one really difference, and Matthew has this guy Aram, and Luke has this guy Arni, and Admin. So Matthew, according to Davies and Allison in his commentaries, Matthew's pulling from the Greek translation, the Septuagint, and he seems to be taking the names from there. They also say, or they're pointing, these guys, Davies and Allison, are pointing out that this is a bit of an oddity or a quirk, an irregularity for the early Christian writers to allude to another book that doesn't get alluded to very often. And that book is in the Old Testament. Also has some genealogies that measure up quite nicely with Matthew. Anybody know where that is found? In the Old Testament. A book that doesn't get quoted very often in New Testament or early Christian sources.
Chronicles?
Chronicles. Matthew seems to be pulling from the first three chapters of Chronicles in his genealogy. So he's doing something very Hebraic. This is found rampant in Old Testament is lineage and family names. You think of what happens immediately before Noah. Noah's story of his family story. What's right before that? A genealogy from Adam to what, Shem, something like this. And then right before Abraham's narrative, what else do we have? A genealogy of so there's this hey, welcome back. So Matthew's doing something very Hebraic, and maybe he's acting pretty scholarly because he quotes from a book that doesn't get quoted very often, and so it tells you something about what he knows, what he's familiar with. Maybe what's unique about this genealogy? Did you catch anything? Who gets mentioned that grabs your attention? Or is there anything missing? Is there anything missing? I know it's like you just focus on trying to say the name right, that we just read too fast over. Maybe some glaring or blaring things that should catch our attention. So did you catch anything? What's that? Women. And what kind of women are named?
Rahab.
Ruth.
Tamar.
And the wife.
Two more. The wife of?
Well, Mary.
Mary.
And the wife of Leah.
Leah. Okay. Who would we expect should be named? If women are going to be mentioned in a genealogy, who would you expect would be named in a genealogy?
Sarah.
Who else gets a lot of attention in Hebrew Bible? Got one matriarch.
Rebecca, Rachel,
some of these like matriarchs that get actually a lot of text or significant text, like the writers are focusing on them. They're not even mentioned, but we have some kind of scandalous women of the Bible that get mentioned. So why are they mentioned? Maybe what is Matthew maybe trying to do?
Oh, because maybe Mary was known to be scandalous.
Okay, you like jumped right to, you know, you went way ahead. That's awesome.
Because she, you know, probably because she got pregnant before her wedding.
Yeah, so Joe is clearly awesome and seeing the end of the road. That Matthew maybe he is trying to do something that connects Mary to these women, maybe because she was, you know, seen as maybe scandalous. We don't know. There's nothing said about Mary as far as how people thought of her or you know, what the family treated her like. We just don't know. So maybe he's trying to connect her to sort of the bizarre, not bizarre, the unique sort of marriage unions that take place in the Bible, right? Rahab and Salmon. We don't even know that she gets married to Salmon, I don't believe, in the Hebrew Bible. There's no talk of this marriage union. It's just thrown out there. Apparently that was some kind of tradition that we don't know about, maybe. Maybe you could help us out if you know. Feel free to throw things out. How about Ruth?
She's a Moabite.
All right.
A Moabite, and she very scandalously gets in the...
Right, there may be with Boaz. I mean, this really righteous guy. So there's some scandalous maybe hintings at that in Ruth. What about Tamar? This is a nice clear one, right? We don't even say much about this other than she took it upon herself to do something pretty scandalous. And Uriah's wife. Matthew doesn't even give her name, maybe because he's trying to elicit some kind of feeling, right? That what did David do to this guy? He has him killed, right? And this marriage between David and Bathsheba is a result of a murder, for one thing. And then who gets born out of that? Solomon. I mean, there's something very unique about this marriage union that, it's not a...
It's adulterous.
It's adulterous, and there is murder involved. So it's very, maybe Matthew is trying to portray to the audience that, hey, listen, Mary's not the only unique sort of situation, of something either supernatural, something... a marriage that is a bit, out there or not fitting to the norms that you should be reminded of these women and their marriages and how they got connected to God's big purpose or plan throughout this redemptive history in Israelite history. Okay, are men are women usually mentioned in genealogies in Hebrew Bible?
I can't think of an instance, really. Not really. Except, I mean, Genesis at the beginning, if you get, what's his name has two wives. What's the guy's name? The
Lamech.
End of Lamech. Lamech has two wives. Okay. So they get mentioned. Of course, Eve at the beginning.
But in any of the other later, parts of the Hebrew Bible...
It's very uncommon. I don't think there's
it's not usual. Chronicles. There are exceptions.
Are there?
There are exceptions. A few in Genesis. Chronicles has a few.
Oh, does that? Okay.
Like the daughter of Shua. There's some really interesting ones that are just kind of in there. Like Bat-Asher.
Mm-hmm.
There's another daughter of Asher that get mentioned. But it's not normal. And so when Matthew's throwing four of them in there, there's a reason that he's doing it. And like I would agree with Joe, and I think she's obviously Davies and Allison are in the same view that Matthew's trying to do something to show what's going on with Mary and Joseph and the Holy Spirit, and what God is doing with this marriage union is maybe shocking to the first century, but they shouldn't forget about these other marriage unions that took place as well. Okay, cool. We're done. Again, what's the I think we kind of got to the common denominator of these women.
And yeah. The common denominator we're saying is
the common denominator is this nature of their marriage union, right?
Can I go through one thing in the just play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
One thing in the opposite direction. Here Rahab is just mentioned by her name, and it's not Rahab the prostitute.
Yeah.
Whereas the other references to her in the New Testament are Rahab the prostitute. It's kind of like her title.
Yeah.
And I don't know about other Second Temple Jewish literature. I don't know because I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting here that he just pulls her name out, which that's one thing that sort of goes the opposite direction.
Yep. And, she's not...
She's not known for anything else.
But I mean, it's not like when you say Uriah, the wife of Uriah, it's kind of like okay, boom, you have to face with Uriah because why is he brought into the thing?
Mm-hmm.
But when it's so typical to say Rahab the prostitute, mm-hmm. Why drop that out? I mean, what are you trying to do by that? People would be going, wait a second, that's Rahab the prostitute you're talking about, right?
Right.
Yeah. No.
So is he trying to detract from? I'm just saying, why is that? piece of evidence slightly not in the same picture? Or
sure.
Going the opposite direction?
I don't know that. I know that in this commentary they seem pretty firm that it is the same Rahab.
For sure.
Yeah. Although there's something strange about this guy Salmon, because there's another Salmon mentioned in the genealogies or these texts that have, you know, all these names in it, and it's like time difference is about 200 years. So there's some, what do you do with that if it's the same? There's some challenges with that text. But I'm sorry, what was, did you have a question attached to that, or just kind of throw that in?
No, I remember listening to a podcast by, I forget this, I remember he's a British scholar, I forget his name, but he puts out three options. One is that they all have shady sexual or potentially dubious sexual backgrounds or stories about them. The second is that they're all foreigners. Mm-hmm. And the third one is something else. And I can't remember which one he ends up landing on, but I remember there's sort of, it seems like there's holes in a couple of them. Even the foreigner one doesn't quite work because...
With Bathsheba, I mean, that's a nice Hebrew name.
Right.
And Tamar is...
Tamar is nice.
Well, Tamar, doesn't Judah go somewhere else? Doesn't he leave the whole crew, he settles somewhere else and marries someone local? Or his kids, or his children marry someone, people local? I don't remember that story, but Bathsheba, well, she marries a foreigner. I don't know, there's some... Yeah. Those were the two options, and then there's a third one, I don't remember what it was. If I'm even remembering, this podcast was from a couple of years ago, so.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's some, there is some positive, I mean, Tamar is looked at positively in other literature. Ruth is obviously looked positively within, and Tamar, looked positively within Scripture.
For sure.
In the ends of, you know, chapter 38 of Genesis and the end of Ruth 4, there's, I mean, Ruth is looked at positively. So that, you know, it's not, you can argue, I think, a couple different ways. But it seems, I mean, I like how Davies and Allison are looking at this and saying, you know, perhaps Matthew is doing, including these women, in order to remind people of sort of how God can work with, you know, foreigners and scandalous people. And it's not like he's saying Mary, what's going on with Mary is a similar thing, is the same thing, that she's scandalous, but that God is doing something, and sometimes, you know,
with a seemingly questionable situation.
Yeah, with a you know, how do you explain this one? Okay. Good, right. So, this pregnancy that Mary has is a bit of an extraordinary circumstance. Maybe it's too wild for people to believe, but he wants to remind them. Okay. Really, verse 6 is kind of the turning point. After this, then we have a list of all this royalty that follows David. Right. So, let's look at verse 8 and 9 a second here. What do you notice? What do you notice? Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Is there any problems there? How about we look, because I think it would take a while to think about. Let's look at 1 Chronicles. Just keep your finger here and go to verses 10 to 13. 1 Chronicles 10 to 13. 1 Chronicles 3. And whoever gets there, just read ahead or read on out loud for us, please. Ten to 13.
The descendants of Solomon, oh, here, Rehoboam, Abijah his son, Asa his son, Jehoshaphat his son, Joram his son, Ahaziah his son, Joash his son, Amaziah his son, Azariah his son, Jotham his son.
Okay, we'll stop there a second. Azariah. Who is this? Azariah goes by another name.
Right. Uzziah.
Yeah.
Right.
Did you notice anything there? How about look in verse 11 and 12 and And if you still have Matthew, look at that verse 8 and 9.
Okay.
And now let's see if you can find anything. Do you notice anything? Is there anybody missing from Matthew's genealogy?
Yeah, Ahaziah and Joash.
And?
Afterwards,
Amatsiah is also missing. Three guys are missing. Why would Matthew, and this is not the only time Matthew does this, but this is just an example. Why does Matthew exclude people that are clearly in the genealogy in the biblical, in Hebrew Bible?
To get to 14.
That's one way to get to 14. Others have argued. That seems to be a nice way, right? To keep that harmony going of 14 generations. Some have suggested like it's intentional. They're bad kings, but who else in Matthew's genealogy is not a good guy? Not a good king.
Menashe, or
Rehoboam.
Yeah.
Rehoboam, or Ahaz, right? Ahaz is also
bad.
Not a great king. Another suggestion has been made that perhaps this is due to the curse over the house of Ahab, this third and fourth generation, right? Because Athaliah is the mother. Or married to Ahaziah, the mother of Joash, that there's a suggestion that maybe that he was familiar with this tradition and just dropped off these guys for that reason. Maybe more practically, it keeps to harmony, and these guys were the easy scapegoats to exclude. Also, there's also a rabbinic tradition that says the sons of the sons are the son. It doesn't really matter, right? This lineage of royalty, they all could be labeled as sons. So there's another thought there. Verse 13 to 16. What do we have in Matthew? Verse 13 to 16. Zerubbabel, father of Yehud, father of Eliakim, Eliakim the father of Azor, Azor the father of Zadok, Zadok the father of Akim, Akim the father of Eliud. And Eliud the father of Eliezer the father of Matan, Matan the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Joseph, who is the husband of Mary, who was born Jesus, who is called the Christ. There is 500 years between Zerubbabel and Joseph. Clearly, nine guys in between Zerubbabel and Joseph don't equal 500 years. I mean, it just doesn't work. Luke's account has 18 names, so double of what Matthew has between the two. So that's just another interesting thing. Again, Matthew he's liking this 14 generation harmony, but that should perk our attention. What is Matthew doing?
Mm-hmm.
What is he trying to do? And we get to Joseph, the parents. We can spend some time here in a second. What do we know about Joseph from the Gospels? How is he described? What's he like? Think of, aside from Matthew 1 here, what do you know about Joseph? Or anything about Joseph from the Gospels?
He's a righteous man.
He's a righteous man, yep.
He gets a lot of dreams.
Okay, he gets visions, yeah.
He's like the other Joseph.
Yeah. And there's been some typological things going on there, perhaps. And he's also the son of a Jacob. There's just some interesting things going on there. But what else do we know about Joseph?
He never fathered Jesus.
Okay, yeah, we'll get to that problem in a sec.
He's wanting to protect her honor.
Okay, yeah, that. In the rest of chapter 1, he seems to be a pretty upright guy that wants to protect Mary. Go ahead.
Apparently he's from the line of David.
From the line of David. But the rest of the Gospels, how does he get referred to?
He's just a tecton.
A tecton, or Yeah, but his typical term is he's the husband of Mary.
Right.
Or husband of Mary, or the father of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not in Matthew. That's in John, and it's in John, the father of Jesus. It's not even in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. But he basically gets to be a bystander or kind of a spectator after these infancy narratives.
Mm-hmm.
He does not get a lot of attention, and there's maybe some reason for that. Maybe he dies early on in Jesus' childhood, because we don't even hear about him after the age of 12. After Jesus turns 12, we don't hear anything more of Joseph. So it's possible that he died, or we have no knowledge after that. But he basically gets sort of spectator status after the infancy narratives. Right, Matthew 1 tells us he's Davidic, he's upright, he has visions, and he's obedient to the Lord. Right, we'll get to this. Is, next question here is how does Matthew describe the relationship of Jesus to Joseph? At that last verse there, 16, what is the relationship between Jesus and Joseph?
Very circuitous kind of
okay.
Phrase.
Does he ever get called the father of Jesus? No, so Matthew's careful on how he describes Joseph's relationship to Jesus. Jesus never gets called the son of Joseph. And in Matthew, he never gets called the father of Jesus in Matthew. Joseph, son of David. And that's blaring, right? That's a clear connection to the Davidic line. How about Mary's relationship to Joseph? How does that get described in this verse? Between Joseph and Mary.
They're married.
They're married, right? He just says that Joseph, the husband of Mary, and maybe what Matthew's up to is avoiding calling her the wife of Joseph. Maybe, just because of this strange thing with the Holy Spirit. Maybe. I mean, that's one argument that they make. What do we know about Mary?
In terms of her lineage?
Yeah, family, or just personality, maybe. You know, what do we know about her?
Up until verse 16?
Mm-hmm. Or in general, the Gospels. What do you know about this woman?
Well, one of her cousins is of the priestly, or married into at least the priestly
Elizabeth,
family.
Yeah, and
her relative, Zechariah. Not necessarily cousin.
Which is definitely not the tribe of Judah.
Okay.
Which makes you,
Okay. Is Elizabeth her sister?
No, it's
a relative.
Cousin, right? Relative to... but really, aside from that Luke text, Matthew doesn't share much other than she's the mother of Jesus. I mean, that's what she gets sort of labeled as. We know very little about her.
We know she has other kids. She has four other boys and some daughters. We don't know how many daughters. At least two.
Yeah. But we like family background. We don't know a whole lot of that. I mean, it's okay. We know a little, but it's.
We know
things about her.
Yeah.
And she's a vessel of the Holy Spirit. She gets connected to the Lord in an intimate way. The next big problem is...
The brothers of Jesus, is that... because that's interpreted one way, another way, cousins and whatever. Is that fair?
Yeah. I did not... Since it's not really in Matthew 1, I didn't do a ton on that. I know Richard Bauckham did something on All in the Family. There's an article on that.
Cool.
It was a while back that tries to deal with that, the brothers and whatnot, if they're from Joseph, from another marriage, or are they married? I don't remember the article content off of my head, but there's plenty of things. I mean, there's going to be lots of suggestions, but
anyway.
There's a lot of stuff out there. This genealogy is followed by a story that. I mean, probably won't get into it, but it indicates that Joseph had no involvement fathering Jesus, right? It was clearly the Holy Spirit that was at work here. And according to these guys, Davies and Allison, Matthew has in mind a legal, not a physical descent and that this transmission of legal heirship is really the focus here. Joseph gave Jesus his name. It says it twice in the rest of that text there, that Joseph was the one to name Jesus. He was told to. And thereby accepted this role as father. And this is not a isolated example. There's lots of examples in the Egyptian history has this stuff, right? We have a pharaoh who inherits the throne from his father, and at the same time, each pharaoh is regarded as the son of who? Ra, right? This the solar deity. So there's this dual paternity going on here. The pharaohs claim paternity, through human and through divine process or whatever. And so their royal rank is from the human father. I mean, that's where their royal rank, their status in the culture is through that. Assyrians do the same, similar kind of thing as Ashur, in the ancient world. Greeks, an example from Odysseus, he's heir to the throne of Ithaca because of his human father, Laertes. I think that's how you say that. Maybe I'm wrong. But he's the king of Ithaca, so Odysseus inherits because of his father. In the Iliad, Odysseus is addressed as the Zeus-born son of Laertes. So he, too, gets sort of this status of having dual paternity as being the son of a god and the son of Laertes, right? Okay, so this is the same, a similar thing is going on there. This is not to say that. Well, I don't know what I could be saying here, but there are examples of this sort of thing. So it's not a paradox, I think, if that's right. This is not an isolated, hey, look at, this is kind of wacko. There are other examples within the Greek world and within the ancient world, up until Middle Bronze Age, it's that we know about. So it's not that this is isolated. So, is Jesus the son of God or the son of Joseph? How can we solve this? How do we solve it?
You mean to answer the question?
Yeah, how do we solve?
Well, it says various places in this say not by human. Jesus was conceived not by human. Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah, well, what do we do with this? There's a whole genealogy that wants to connect Jesus to David.
Mm-hmm. Through Joseph.
Through Joseph. And yet, Joseph is clearly not the father.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what do we do? How do we resolve this? How can we solve this issue? Or resolve the issue? Does Luke do something similar? Does Luke connect Jesus to David in the same
nobody
way?
Nobody talks about Mary's. Or does somebody talk about
Luke, Mary's? Luke has a genealogy through Mary.
Yeah.
Through Mary, right? But David is in there.
Yeah, David is in there through a different way.
Through a different way. Mm-hmm.
But
can you explain how it's through Mary? Because I've heard that, but when I read it looks like it's still through Joseph, and I thought you just said at the beginning it's the same. So I'm really trying to figure this out before.
Okay.
And it's very confusing.
Of who it's through?
Who is the genealogy for?
Who is the genealogy
why do
for?
Why people say it's for Mary when it's
Luke
not?
Through
when,
through.
I mean, simply reading
I think
it.
Because Luke says something like, it is said of Joseph, so implying that people think this, but it's not, or something. I don't know. Don't people say, isn't that what it says? Let's look at it.
In Luke? Okay, we'll go to Luke here. we'll come back to Matthew 1, and I'll see if I can help answer the best I can. Do you want to look in Luke 2? Is that where you're looking, Joe?
I think it's 3. Isn't it?
Yeah, 3.
Four?
Yeah, it's 3.
3:23.
Well, one way, while you're looking, one way you can possibly resolve it is like those different examples of Tamar and Rahab and all these other ones. Like, when you're adopted, you are legitimately considered of that family. Mm-hmm. So once you've been grafted, you're in, and it doesn't, you know, no one's to ask of whether you're a blood relative. Mm-hmm. You're as good as, kind of.
Right. So
maybe Jesus being connected through that line, because he grew up in that household, mm-hmm. is good enough. You know, there isn't.
And
maybe.
And Matthew seems to have no problem connecting Jesus to David, even though she was born of Mary. He spends all this time describing how he's connected to David through mm-hmm. Joseph.
Right.
So there's
through the father's line. It has to be through the father.
It's through the husband of the mother.
So he gives her legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because he married her.
Right. So his status.
Not because he's the father of the child.
Right. His status is not dependent on Mary. It's the husband of his mother, which is Joseph. That is his status. That's his, you know.
And that would be Jesus by Joseph. So that's the way it works.
Yeah. And Matthew wants to clarify. You know, it's through David, but it has some really nice history, and there's 14 generations. I mean, he really like makes a nice big deal
very
about
tiny,
it. Yeah, it's very nice and clean. And I mean, I don't know. What would you say? What would you add, Jordash?
I don't know. I don't know what I would add.
Did you want to make a comment to Luke 3?
Well, like Luke, very clearly gets a lot of his sources from at least Mary's tradition, right? Like, especially the birth narrative, it's all from Mary's perspective. So it sounds like his source is at least through Mary or sources close to Mary. And so it makes sense. And so I think that people, didn't I hear, I thought I heard something like Joseph in verse Luke, where'd it go? Luke 3:23.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you know, that he was said to be known
he was
as
son. So it was thought.
It was thought of Joseph, and it says Joseph of Eli, right? And
all these other names, yeah.
Right.
Not familiar.
But it's not the same as Joseph, son of Jacob.
Jacob.
In Matthew, mm-hmm. And it could be that Eli was his father-in-law, Joseph to Eli, like. You know. So Mary's dad.
I think the tradition for Mary is that her mother, like, there's a virgin birth with Mary. There's a tradition. I mean, Catholic doctrine, but, you know, that Mary was, that her mother was also, like, one child, and Anna, and they have names, and it's not Hebrew. Anna and
yeah, another.
So I don't know.
Early writing. Yeah, I'm not familiar with other. I didn't look up any of the traditions of the family tree. But that is interesting. I mean, there's for sure discrepancies between the two texts. But it does look like Joseph is somehow the focus, or Joseph's line is the focus.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that Jesus' identity is based off of his mother's husband. Through whether that be through adoption, it doesn't seem to matter to Matthew. Apparently, I mean, that's just the way that I'm seeing this. Is there seems to be no issue with that, even though there's not a physical paternity of Joseph because of what was going on with what God was doing with him. There doesn't seem to be a problem. Although it doesn't, just it kind of grinds us a little bit. That it's not so clean, and maybe that's
why they're talking about a direct line,
yeah.
A paternity line, and then they change the rule at the very end, right?
Yeah, and if there are rules, right? I mean, to us, maybe there needs to be, but
well, I mean, there are cases in which the line goes through the mother in Chronicles. At least one case I can think of where it does. It's usually through the tribe of Manasseh. Actually, a lot of the. I think there are three cases where the line goes through the mother in from Menashe. But so it's not terribly, you know, it's not unheard of. So
yeah. There's a nice one page little summary. I mean, I think that's it would be considered a summary that Cyrus Gordon did on this problem, and what to do with Jesus's his being born of Mary and having Joseph not being his physical father, and yet there, Matthew seems to be like merging the two. And we nailed a couple of them down. He also says too, it's not the divine paternity of Jesus, but the genealogy of Joseph that legitimizes him as king of the Jews. That's his statement about that. That is, this divine fatherhood is given to Jesus, and his human genealogy and kingship come through his mother's husband, in accordance with patriarchal character of this Hebrew society. Examples of from the Greeks, from the Egyptians, Assyrians. It's not out of place to connect someone like Jesus' circumstance, to connect him to a genealogy, even though it's not physical birth. That's what I'm understanding. Maybe that can be disputed or argued in a different way, but from some of these guys that have done the hard work, they seem to portray that this is not a paradox. This is not as big of an issue as what sort of we today in the modern world would understand it to be an issue. This dual paternity, human and divine, is within the ancient world, and that it's one's position in society didn't come from divine father, but his mother's husband, they argue. According to this royal genealogy of Jesus through Joseph, it's not a paradox in the realm of the Near East context. From Bronze Age to the Roman times, there are examples. So I don't know if that helps you sleep at night, but there, what Matthew is up to is, hopefully it grinds you less. These guys that I talked about that did this commentary had five concluding observations, and I want to read them to maybe help us understand or just come to some sort of conclusion here. The biblical account of Noah, Genesis 5-9, begins with a genealogy. Abraham's story in Genesis 11-25 also begins with a genealogy. Before it opens into the narratives. And the chronicler that we read from Chronicles 1-3, he presses his account of the kings of Judah with several genealogies prior to that. So from this, it appears that certain Old Testament texts served Matthew as a model, and implies that that Matthew thought of his gospel as a continuation, maybe, of the biblical history. Maybe he's using this as a sort of ploy. And maybe he wanted to sort of model it after the same sort of literary category, the same type of writing style. And if you notice, what did Jesus, according to Matthew, and this is kind of jumping a little bit ahead, but did he come to be a list of Judean kings, right? This royalty, political royalty. And is Matthew trying to paint Jesus as being in the same vein as political royalty and to do what they came to do or what they did? To be a physical king, to be a political ruler? The answer is still in chapter 1. We haven't read it yet, but check out 21. What kind of kingdom or kingship? What is he going to do?
Save his people from their sins.
He's going to save them. That's one of his high objectives, according to Matthew 1, is to save people from sin. And that's a big objective in his kingship, is verse 21 there.
That would make me think of Josiah immediately, or Hezekiah, or someone like that.
These big timers.
Who are saving their people from their sins.
Yeah.
Who are going around smashing idols, taking down high places, saving the people out of what the kings before them had set them up to do. And the way that Jesus does it is what turns it all on its head. Mm-hmm. He saves them from their sins, but in some funkier way.
That's real good. That's a great observation. Five points here that these guys make, Davies and Allison make. And one is that this section offers, this genealogy offers proof that proof of Jesus' title, that Jesus is the son of Abraham and the son of David, right? Right from verse 1 there. Son of Abraham, son of David. And because Jesus is, through his father, a descendant of King David, and there's, in this respect, he qualifies as a Davidic Messiah. A second point that they make. Jesus came at the right time. This history is divided into periods and places, and that the appearance of Jesus at the end of an exilic era, right? The end of Zerubbabel's, these guys that come after him, this, he comes at the end of this exilic period. So the time of Jesus' birth, or the Messiah's birth, falls really nicely in line with this eschatological calendar, according to these guys. If you remember what Galatians 4 says, right? Someone wants to turn that, you can. Galatians 4:14, and read this. But there's, Paul is talking about Jesus like really coming in the fullness of time, like it was ripe, or it was exactly when it needed to be, I guess. The timing was just was perfect. Do you have it, Danny?
Mm-hmm. 4:14?
Yeah.
And my trial, which was in my flesh, you did not despise or reject, but you received me as an angel of God, even as Christ Jesus. Galatians
4:14.
Yeah.
That was it?
That was it.
That didn't seem right. Huh. Well, that didn't seem right. Oh, never mind about that one. That was it. Anyways, we'll have to look that up later. A third point that they make, that this genealogy outlines a story whose surety is God and whose culmination is Jesus Christ. God gave promises to Abraham, gave promises to David, and throughout Israel's history, these promises seem to be in jeopardy all the time, right? Say, like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, all these promises of children, and it like never happens. It took like 25 years for Isaac to be born from the promise at the beginning to the actual fulfillment. Like there's everything always just seems in jeopardy in the biblical text, and yet God still is keeping his promises and working despite people and despite scandals and relationships and marriages. He remains faithful despite appearances, and it comes out fully at the birth of Jesus. The fourth, yeah.
It's still like he keeps his promises, but not in the way that anyone expected him to. Like if you read in the Old Testament, it's always do this, like the Davidic Messiah, this and this, and then when we finally get to do this, it's not exactly. And so it's a fulfillment in a way that no one realized. And it just makes me nervous for how we read the Old Testament when we look for interpretations and ways to understand God when we see all these ways that he hasn't fulfilled exactly the way people expected to and could be expected to expect to. If that makes sense. I find this very troubling.
Which this whole genealogy part?
I've had so many Jewish friends come to me and say, look, it says in Matthew that he's not really. And if that is how people are reading and understanding, because this is how the text says, you just say to them, well, you're not reading it right. You need to understand the context and this and this.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is an element of it that seems, I mean, I know people don't like the word, but deceptive a little bit. Not maliciously, obviously, but.
But even by Jewish, like modern Jewish standards, you're Jewish through your mother, but your tribe is through your father. So what are they talking about, even through their own modern Jewish state? Like, I don't think they know what they're talking about, basically.
Do you mean the genealogy, or do you mean the way he'll come, king or conqueror, or save your people?
Like, or both, like, you're saying, like, the text says, the prophecy says he's going to come one way, and then the text describe it differently than the prophecies say he's supposed to come.
Yes, that's what I mean. And the quality of the kingship, that it would come and be a king versus he would come and save his people. And that's the part you're talking about that's deceptive or confusing.
It's just that it retroactively, it makes sense, but is it the... when you're looking for something to come, you have an expectation, and when it's flipped on you, it seems unfair a little.
You know, but nothing really in the biblical text is ever clean and tidy. I mean, that's clear from this genealogy. It's clear from the life of David. And I mean, why would God continually work with David if he if he's adulterous? If his kids, you know, are like, what a messed up sort of way of bringing about a Messiah or a messianic, you know, lineage. And just through it all, it just nothing seems really clean and tidy. I mean, there's a Moabite in there. I mean, if Rahab is the same one, a Canaanite, that all these people that God is saying, you know, rid them or don't or exclude them from my temple, and yet God is in, like, bringing them in to this, and not just, you know, into the community, but into this messianic line. That's even more challenging. But
I think everything, the entire Bible, I think is that, you know, like, they're in Egypt and they're going to be redeemed from Pharaoh, and the first thing they hit is the most unpassable desert. You know, what's up with that? You said you're going to bring us in the promised land, and we're in this intractable desert. You know, and then they get to the promised land, and it's full of giants. Like every it's never bliss. Every time they're supposed to get to this thing that's supposed to be, you know, it's always obstructed by some massive obstacle that wasn't. Hey, what happened to the heaven that you promised? And even heaven, or even, you know, the Garden of Eden has this snake in the middle. That's, you know, like, there's always. I think it's never. There's always irony, and there's always contradiction, and there's always. So I don't think. I think that's consistent, you know. I think that Jesus comes, and that the Messiah comes at a time when he comes to rule as Messiah, and yet the Romans are there, and
yet his kingdom is still working within
this
sort of setting of Roman rule.
Yeah,
he's got his own kingdom that's active,
right? Mm-hmm. And that's the real kingdom, despite. But yeah, it looks like, or it is finagling.
Yeah, I didn't think that, you know, we would all come to some sort of. I tried to ask about how do we solve this, but not really feeling like it would be a full answer, because nothing in Matthew that in this chapter is really easy. It seems. I mean, although he just doesn't seem to have a problem with it.
Right.
You know. This is the way God wanted to do it, and here's how he did it. You know, he just ran through, you know, Joseph's line, and this is how God intended it to be. This is how God wanted to use it, and apparently it's okay. I mean, maybe there's more to it. Maybe I'm just thinking too simply, but you know, I guess I'm willing to. I mean, I'm willing to accept it for sure, because the early community seemed to be okay with it as well, and you know, irregularities and these scandalous marriages that happen within the text seem to be blessed by God, and if God can work within that, then, you know, it doesn't make it easy, but
I think like Jesus too is like, I mean. Throughout the Bible, too, like the chosen people that represent God's plan are always a small, insignificant people in this part of the world. They never become the United States superpower. They're always this little people that keep getting kicked around by the bigger players. Like,
how big did Solomon ever get? He got pretty big, but
he did. Yeah. I mean, that
and
but not really. He's even in Solomon's day. He is still a minor player that is, you know.
And the only other time they get really sizable is like when Jeroboam II up north and Uzziah down south have no external threats on them.
Yeah.
Everybody's got problems. All the big neighbors, Assyria and Egypt and whatever, they all got problems at this time. So it's like they can finally breathe.
Right.
You know? And same thing with probably during Solomon's days.
Yeah, the only reason Solomon is able to get big is because both Egypt and Assyria have internal problems at that time. And they're dealing with
so
that.
So God gives
them
peace for X years, it says, usually, you know, like,
until,
peace
until they get their own house in order, and then they're like, okay, now we can go back to conquering, and then, you know.
Yeah. That's the nature of, if you just watch it, it's sort of, you know, ebb and flow of,
uh-huh.
you know, who wants Israel bad enough, you know, to exploit them for their own purposes of, you know, economic, whatever, you know, for their own reasons.
It can make you a little nervous about heaven.
maybe. A couple last points here. These guys make here. This birth of Jesus involved extraordinary circumstances that sort of, you know, a foreshadow or in the same line as the unions of Judah and Tamar, you know, Rahab and Solomon, Boaz and Ruth, David and Beersheba. That it wasn't uncommon even in Israel's history for there to be these extraordinary marriage unions to take place. And another point, last point here, that this genealogy reveals the identity and status of the church, according to these guys, that congregations included both Jews and Gentiles and could not find their identity in a shared racial heritage. They found it instead in their common Lord and Savior, who was with them when they gathered together. And since he was the Messiah, the son of David and the son of Abraham, those who adhered to his words and participated in his destiny knew themselves to be heirs to the promises made to Abraham and David. In other words, they say, the history of Jesus was his followers' history. His heritage, their heritage, despite its belonging to the rootless Hellenistic world in the first century, the church, by virtue of its union with Jesus, had a secure link with the remote past, with this depth that comes out of this genealogy in Matthew, this root that Jesus came out of, and that it could cross boundaries in the first century that may have caused schisms between Jew and Gentile within the church. Maybe it's a nice thought. I don't think we solved everything.
Okay.
It's good to wrestle with the text, right?
I think it was a good problem to.
So next time you read the genealogy, just pay attention, you know, a little bit more.
So I just thought of something too with the Luke genealogy.
Yeah.
It says Jesus' son. It was thought of Joseph. Of Eli. It doesn't say Joseph, son of Eli.
Hmm.
It says of Eli. Yeah, Joseph of Eli, of blah, 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 blah. So I suppose if you want to use an ellipsis, like the taking son, like, you know, instead of Joseph of Eli, if you want to make it an ellipsis, like a missing son of, then you have to take the missing it was thought of as well. So I don't know. I think maybe, like, just like Matthew very carefully crafted Joseph's relationship to Jesus, it may also be that Luke also carefully crafted the relationship of Joseph to Eli. I don't know, that's my guess. That's a thought.
Good thought.
I mean, that might be, because for a long time people have been thinking that Luke's genealogy is Mary's.
Ah, okay.
Right? Like, it must be. I never read anything about it, but I'm just thinking about it, looking at the text. And
do you want to get that for next week?
Welcome back.
Yeah. Good, but I think what Matthew's point was that he's connecting Jesus to Joseph. Hopefully there was some, you know, slice that you can be okay with, or at least think about it and do further study on it, whatever. But we have what we have, and we sort of have to work with it and wrestle with it. So I hope you can read the genealogy a little bit different next time, and maybe gain some insight and bring it back or share it with someone else. But Shabbat Shalom. And there's a service downstairs.
Do you know where there's other genealogies?